Welcome to the Beveridge Report. Today we have the pleasure of hosting Professor Juliet Shore, a renowned economist and sociologist. She is a leading expert in the field of consumer culture and the impact of consumerism on the economy and the environment. Her work has been widely recognized, and her books, including The Overworked American and The Overspent American, have been widely acclaimed. We will be discussing with her the economic basis of the four-day workweek, its implications and challenges of implementation, consumerism and its impact on the environment, and her advice for women in economics. Special thanks for this episode goes to Sylvia, Alice Odonka, and the rest of LS Economics Department.
So firstly, you started your career as an economist and later specialized in sociology. What motivated you to do this, and what has your economics experience brought to your sociological study?
That's a complicated question. One answer to it has to do with the things that I got interested in. So I started as a labor economist, primarily with also macro as my sort of second idea. My dissertation was on the relationship between macroeconomic variables and things happening at the in the firm, like wages and strike propensity and how hard people were working. I was working on what came to be called efficiency wages in the early days. So how did macroeconomic variables affect how hard the intensity of work, for example. I wrote a book that came out in 1992 called The Overworked American, which came out of those ideas. And I had one chapter in it called the Insidious Cycle of Work and Spend. And I didn't really understand the spending side of it too much. I mean, I had some things that I wrote about, but I gave a lot of talks on that book, and in one of them, someone asked, how do you get out of the cycle of work and spend? And it was a great question I didn't know the answer to. And that led me into sociology, because at the time, economists weren't really doing much on consumption. You know, there was the sort of early post-war work on the consumption function, but many of the assumptions that economists were making about consumption, I think, led them in the wrong direction. In particular, the idea that there was no interpersonal comparison. Now, you know, a few economists had sort of relaxed that assumption, but for the most part, they weren't thinking about that or what we might think of, what I came to call the social pressures to spend. And so as I started to work on that, I naturally went into sociology because that's where people were talking about it. I got very interested in the ideas of the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, and who wrote a really magnificent book on consumption called Distinction. And so that sort of just gradually led me closer and closer to sociology. But I should also say there were some other aspects of my other things that were going on. I mean, one was at the time, economics was so male dominated. It still is, but being a woman was difficult. I was bullied by Larry Summers at Harvard. That had an impact on me. So there was that. And then there was the politics of it. So I had a kind of double whammy because I was both a woman and I was a quote unquote radical economist working outside the dominant paradigm. And that the profession was moving to the right during those years pretty significantly. And so I began to feel more and more marginalized. So those combination of things sort of led me to sociology. Just one little anecdote, which was that a number of times, you know, long before I had gone into sociology or was even paying much attention to it, I had never taken a sociology class. People would call me a sociologist because of the kinds of questions I was interested in. So I suppose there was maybe a certain inevitability that I would end up there one way or another. The final thing, you asked about how it affects my work. Well, I think it has a really big impact because I'm looking at things from both sides. So whether it's the my work on work time, where I sort of really wanted to integrate the consumption and the work side. So that's been a real hallmark of that work. Or in my work on gig labor, where I'm thinking a lot about the economics of platforms, as well as the sort of more sociological experience that workers have. So I try and wear both hats. And I think it does mean that I sometimes go in directions that are different from what somebody just wearing one or another hat would have.
Incredible. And I just want to turn to one of the research topics that you've recently took on. You're a member of the Global Academic Board of the 4-Day Work Week Initiative, the Future of Work. Very recently, the midpoint research results were published for the UK pilot, and they were quite encouraging. Could you please tell us a bit more about the economic, social, and environmental basis for the 4-Day Work Week and its implications for key stakeholders?
Yes, so the 4-Day Work research is really exciting. This is a return for me because I first studied work time in the 1980s and published The Overworked American in the 1990s. And I've continued to do some research on work time, but I moved into a number of other areas, in part because there wasn't really much of an appetite for a shorter work time agenda in the United States, but that's changed. And so at the end of 2021, I started working with a group, an NGO called 4-Day Week Global, which was organizing trials of companies who wanted to give 4 days of work to their employees, but with 5 days pay and with a process of work reorganization so that it's not just a speed up. And it's a 32-hour work week, not a so-called compressed work week, not 4 10-hour days. We started our first trial in February of 2022, and then every 2 months have been pretty much starting a new trial with new companies. They're 6-month trials, and I'm leading a team that's been researching the impacts. So you mentioned the UK trial. It's the largest of the trials, and we are just finishing it up literally in a couple of days. It'll be ending. We are, in fact, releasing results from the first two trials this week on December 1st. On November 30th. We've had really great findings. We're collecting two kinds of data, data on employee outcomes and data on the companies. Now, what got reported in the press on the UK was how the companies are feeling about it. And we're finding very, very high levels of success for the companies. So in the first two trials, we asked companies to rate the trial 0 to 10. They rated it a 9. Asked them about their performance and productivity. They rated those 7.6, 7.7, respectively. And we've been collecting data from them on revenue, which went up over the trial. Big increases in revenue from the previous 6 months in 2021. We want to correct for seasonality. So we're comparing to same 6-month period a year earlier, but also just over the course of the trial, revenue went up by more than 1% a month. Resignations are down. New hiring is up. Absenteeism is down. We don't have productivity measures per se. Not many of our companies actually measure productivity, and it's hard to do in the white collar firms that are the bulk of the participants. But very, very pleased responses from the firms. Employee side, also fantastic. 97% say they prefer the schedule, the 4-day schedule, and want to keep it. A range of well-being outcomes improved. Stress, anxiety, burnout, physical health, mental health, fatigue, more exercise, fewer sleep problems, more satisfaction with life, more satisfaction with time, less work, family conflict. I mean, pretty much you name it. We measured a lot of things and they all improved. Pace of work did not go up, which is interesting. So the reorganization of work worked. People did not take on second jobs, which is something I was worried about given the history in the United States of that phenomenon with shorter work time. And, you know, for economists, maybe the most telling statistic will be willingness to pay. And what we found is that very people will demand a very high level of additional salary to go to back to a 5-day week. 13% said no amount of money could get them there. Another 13% said more than 50% pay increase would be required. But the big bulk of them were in the 25 to 50% salary increase would be required to get people to back to a 5-day.
And in this experiment, did you find any sectoral differences in implementing a 4-day work week? For example, the healthcare sector is usually thought of as overworked. On the other hand, the concept may be different in private sector jobs where the line between work and private life often is a bit blurry.
Yeah, it's a great question. We don't have enough companies in the first two trials. It's 33 companies. We can't really make any sectoral conclusions. We're starting to see more healthcare companies in the later trials. So starting with the UK trial. So we should have something to say on this, you know, sometime in 2023. We'll be releasing UK results in February of 2023. What I would say is this: we're getting more interest from healthcare organizations. And I think the reason is the burnout is leading them to have difficulties keeping and attracting employees. And so I don't think they're going to be able to do a sort of work reorganization that gets them all 20% of that productivity, that, you know, that whole full day off. But they can get some, and then they'll also have cost savings on the reduced attrition and increased ability to hire, competitive advantage in what has become a very, very difficult labor market for attracting people for employers. So that's what I'm thinking is going on with the healthcare firms. We have, for the first time, we have companies that we're starting to work with. Nothing definite yet, but you know, who are planning to put nurses on a 4-day schedule. And so we'll see. We'll see. But one of the things that I'm, you know, always at pains to talk about is that the idea that you could reorganize your way into no change in productivity makes sense in certain kinds of workplaces. And I think tech, finance, marketing, design, you know, some of those are the places where you can do that the most. Healthcare, it's a very different story because you don't have a lot of wasted time or unproductive time. So you can get savings in other ways, and society can get big savings because right now we're spending a lot of resources training people who are burning out and leaving the field. And that's very, very expensive. So there's a change to be made there.
And one of the criticisms that the study may suffer from is that of selection bias, that there is no control group of randomly selected employers. Moreover, it is unclear how robust the measurement of productivity is across the companies, as you said earlier, as it's difficult to measure productivity. How would you respond to these criticisms?
Well, first of all, absolutely, there's a huge selection bias. So what are these studies telling us? They're not telling us that, you know, in an RCT, a randomized controlled trial, You would pick a randomly selected group. You would put them into two different groups, and you would test what happens. And what you're trying to find out there is, does this treatment, in this case, you know, this is a model that comes from medicine, you know, which is about medicines or, you know, various kinds of treatment. Does this treatment work for everybody? And of course, we're not, you know, we've just talked about that issue. No one is saying that this treatment works for everybody. I mean, maybe someone is, but I certainly am not. What we're trying to find out with these kinds of trials is, can it work for some? So we are showing that it can work. You can think of it as a demonstration project. You can think of it as a proof of concept. And yes, ideally, we want to go down that road. But let me say the RCT road. But let me say a couple of things. I think it's going to be very difficult to get a true random sample because you have to induce companies to do this. I can't. I mean, it's one thing. And truly, in a quote unquote RCT, you also have to induce patients to do it. So they're not truly random because you're not a dictator who can stand over the sample and say, you must do this. And it's a lot easier with patients in a medical trial, but where you're trying to get companies to make a major change in what they do, who am I, the researcher, to have that power over them? So the people who are sort of jumping up and down and saying, you don't have an RCT, they haven't thought it through, honestly, about what it would take to get an RCT. Now, you can get closer. It's just like true randomization, very difficult without a dictator. Second point is, to some extent, for the employees, there's not a selection bias because they're not choosing the trial. It's the management. And in many cases, it's the CEOs or the founders. There is some selection bias there because we would assume, or we think, the CEOs will know their employees and will have a sense that this will work for them. So the randomization issue is the selection bias issue is a little less pronounced for the employees. So I think what we did try actually to get some controls. We had a large British company that was going to take part of its company onto the 4-day week and part not. They ended up delaying or maybe not joining in the end. They got a new CEO. But we're working towards that in future trials where we get some big companies that will give us some control groups as we go through. I think for the employees, it's not a big issue because there's lots and lots of research on how shorter work time, you know, yields these kinds of well-being findings that we're seeing. And many of those had controls. It's really more about the firms. And as I say, no one is claiming that this will work for everybody.
For sure. Seeing the positive results of the preliminary trials, what advice would you give to companies trying to implement a 4-day work week? And what are the potential barriers to implementation of such a work week? Like, for example, what regulations could perhaps help or hinder the successful implementation of the 4-day work week?
So in terms of advice for companies who are implementing, I would say the first one is that you need to give the employees the ability and opportunity to figure out how to reorganize work in a way that doesn't, that allows them to reduce the unproductive time. So what many of the companies have found is that they have an unproductive meeting culture or an inefficient meeting culture, too many distractions. People can move personal appointments, errands and things to the off day. So they're able to figure out these kinds of things. They shift to sort of more time efficient communication styles and so forth. So giving the employees the ability to do that, it's hard to do it from the top down. But there's one piece of that that we also recommend, and it goes to something you asked me in the previous question that I didn't answer, which is productivity. So economists are, you know, very concerned about productivity. And one of the things we say is, first of all, most of these companies are not measuring productivity. And so we say, don't start measuring productivity with the change, because suddenly, you know, putting your employees under a microscope more than you did before doesn't necessarily make sense, and it could backfire. Also, very, very hard to measure productivity in a lot of these cases. Figure out what is important to you as a company. What are your success metrics? Maybe it's revenue, maybe it's customer satisfaction, maybe it's growth, maybe it's profitability, whatever it is, that's what you need to measure. Individual productivity, you know, why does that matter so much if you are successful as a company? I mean, maybe you could be more successful if you got individual productivity up, but it's really not all that advised. And companies are having success with this model. So that's where we are in that. The barriers. So I think not being prepared for this is one barrier. Compensation practices that don't align with a model like this is another one. You have to think that through. So for example, one firm in our early trials had a group of people who were paid on commission. Well, the amount of time they work, you know, doesn't really necessarily align with what they get paid. They didn't end up mostly taking advantage of the 4-day week. They already had, you know, a kind of flexibility. So making sure that if you're going to do this, it'll work for all your employees. And so some of them resented the fact that everybody else got a 4-day week, and, you know, it didn't really work for them. The company maybe should have, you know, increased the commission or something to make it possible for them to shift. So that's one thing. I think another big thing is, you know, senior management or upper management not trying to micromanage this process. And, you know, we really preach that empowering the people at that first level.
So shifting gears now, over the years, you've written various articles on consumerism and how we as a society can achieve a sustainable future. The environmental result of consumerism is, of course, that we are using up the resources. And for this year, the Earth overshot the day was 28th of July, whereas it was 18th of August last year, which is an alarming difference. Why do you think consumerism and vertical emulation has become so embedded in our culture and society?
Yeah, I think that the sort of, it's so difficult to slow down what I've called the process of competitive consumption, which is, you know, standards going up and people needing to consume more to keep pace. So difficult to restrain that because it's driven by inequality. And so as inequality rises, which it has in so many places around the world, as inequality rises, it's sort of fuel for that competitive consumption. So I think that's the core of the difficulty, that the structures of consumption are rooted in structures of inequality. And those, it's also very much connected to work time, as I have written for many decades. Long hours of work lead to higher levels of consumption, both through income and also through that people have less free time, do things in more carbon intensive ways. If we're talking, I've looked specifically at carbon use. And so one of the big hopes for the 4-day week is that it can help to sort of decelerate the pace of life. We've got a little bit of evidence on this in the trials where we're finding that people in the before, we're doing a before and after methodology and asking them about how much walking and cycling they do. We're seeing reduced commuting, even as they're going back into the office more. So giving people more what's called time affluence also allows them to live in more sustainable ways. So I think it's that combination of work hours and inequality that are really key. And we have some work. One of my grad students has been looking at that interaction between work time and concentrated inequality at the top of the distribution, and finding that in more unequal societies, not only do you get more carbon emissions, and that's something we found in a number of different papers, but the effect of work hours on carbon emissions gets more intense with more inequality.
And your recent book, After the Gig, was released during the pandemic. And I just want to understand, how do pandemics and global crises affect trends in consumerism?
Well, the pandemic, you know, led to big changes in consumer patterns, of course. During a lockdown, a lot of things people can't do. So we saw a collapse in carbon emissions. People couldn't travel, they couldn't buy much. In the early days, people were just buying necessities, really food and household goods that they needed to sustain themselves. And then you get other things. You have government stimulus payments in the United States that led to purchasing. As the economy picked back up again, carbon emissions, you know, regained their, you know, relentless rise. And then there are some longer lasting things like a shift to online purchasing and more delivery as opposed to in person. But I think in the end, the pandemic, although it will have changed, especially temporarily, some things more permanently, the pattern of consumption, what it hasn't done is change the sort of overall sort of consumerist orientation of particularly wealthy societies. There was a lot of talk in the early days of the pandemic that this would lead to changes in people's lifestyles as they really focused on what mattered more to them and so forth. And I think we have seen some of that in the labor market trends, the so-called great resignation, the quiet quitting, the reshuffle, which is people moving from one job to another, higher levels of people exiting the labor force earlier. So that'll give a little bit of a deceleration, that sort of movement out of long hours.
Yeah. So I just want to understand this a bit better. Why has the pandemic not really shifted the preferences of consumers? Why are they so entrenched in society?
Well, I mean, it has shifted them in some ways. You know, I think the movie theaters are not as crowded as they were. You know, there's some sort of health fears. And then you get these transitory effects like a travel boom when people get, you know, able to travel again and so forth. But the pandemic didn't shift the things that drive consumerism. So it shifted the income and wealth distributions in the direction of more inequality. So that would be a boost to consumerism. Some changes in the labor market, which would work in the other direction of people working fewer hours, that would work in the other direction. But it's sort of, you know, it goes back to what I was arguing earlier, which is that thinking about the structure of consumption as coming out of that structure of inequality. And that wasn't transformed by the pandemic. If anything, it led to a more pressure for competitive consumption.
True. So unfortunately, like, the overconsumption of a wealthy minority fuels a climate crisis, yet it is like the poor majority who have to pay the price. Would policy and international cooperation resolve this dichotomy?
Well, it's a really important point. I mean, at its essence, I think we need to understand that the climate crisis, not only as a crisis of physics or science, or but also as a crisis of inequality. And, you know, I've argued this in a recent series of videos on the economics of the climate crisis, which is that the structure of inequality has given us the climate crisis, because if we had a more equal world, we would not have gone for four decades without addressing this, because the gap between who's responsible for climate impacts and who's paying the price. And that's true both at the global level, which is where it's mostly talked about, but it's also true within nations. So it is, the wealthy are disproportionately responsible, and the poor are disproportionately vulnerable. So you've got to have a social movement. I mean, and this is where sociology comes into economics, I think, a social movement that is pushing for a more equitable response. And we saw that at COP27 at Sharm el-Sheikh this year, 2022, where the Global South countries finally just said enough is enough. And I think, you know, people feel that one of the big reasons was the ways in which the Global North countries hoarded vaccines and failed to open up the system in a way that would allow these countries to protect themselves from this virus. And then the knock-on economic impacts of the global economy as a result of the pandemic. And so they're not just suffering disproportionate climate impacts, but disproportionate pandemic and economic impacts. And of course, they just revolted this year and said, no, enough is enough. You've got to take responsibility for this. So, and the Global North countries finally said, okay, although we'll see if they put their money where their mouth is, because in fact, you know, there are numbers associated with this loss and damage, the new fund that is being created. It will happen at a, you know, the global negotiations are part of it, but only when you get that pressure. And I think a big part of why the U.S. finally changed their tune on loss and damage is not only because they're getting pressure from Global South nations, but because the Biden administration has had so much pressure from the climate movement in the United States. It really forced the Democrats to move in a very big way on climate, which is the first time, you know, that hasn't happened before.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's very promising movements. As someone who's a very distinguished academic, what advice do you have for a woman pursuing a career in economics or sociology?
Well, I suppose the advice is pretty different between the two fields. Sociology is, you know, has a very large number of women in it. And, you know, I think it's probably maybe majority women at this time, or at least certainly among younger cohorts. I think, you know, feel your power and, you know, do your thing. it's been like night and day between the two disciplines. In economics, women are still a minority and are, you know, things are changing, but slowly. There's still a tremendous amount of sexism in economics. There's been a, you know, a lot going on online around sort of Me Too, things coming out recently about, you know, people, economists taking each other to strip clubs and, you know, just really problematic practices. And I would say for women economists, I would say number one, bond with other women and organize within the profession. There have been some very promising moves within the AEA. Number two, don't keep quiet when bad things happen. In my generation, when we had sort of Me Too incidents, we just kept quiet. It's important to get that information out to protect each other. Keep pressuring the discipline, both in terms of the social dynamics of the discipline, but also the approaches, the paradigms. There's a lot of implicit sexism in the way theories and models are built in economics, and feminist economists have done a lot of great work sort of laying that bare. And I think also changing the way we do economics as well as the way we relate to each other is important.
Finally, I will say
one last thing. I think there's some of the people going into economics now, going into graduate schools in economics now, many of them are, much more feminist and aware, the men much more feminist and aware of these issues. So that's promising. But if you look at a place like EJMR, Economics Job Market Rumors, which has been analyzed, it's a cesspool of misogyny and racism and class elitism and, just like it's a very ugly place. And it is reproducing that ugliness in the discipline.
Finally, something we ask all our guests, what gives you hope?
So three things give me hope right now. One is the social movements around climate, racial justice in particular. Those two things are really important. The technological and sort of market changes in renewable energy gives me a lot of hope. So I think we are making big strides in our fight against the fossil fuel industry around the world. We're not there yet. They're on the defensive. We're on the offensive. That's a big, big change. And I don't think we could have gotten there if we didn't have a cheaper alternative technology for producing energy. And then, of course, this is very cliched, but, it speaks to something I said a minute ago, but this is a very genuine point. Younger generations give me hope. I have two children, ages 27 and 31, and as well as all my students, so I'm in contact with a lot of young people, and the levels of engagement and political mobilization and their values are really, very inspiring to me.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciated it. And I found the discussion to be very valuable, and I hope that the listeners do as well.
Great. Thank you. It was a real pleasure.